Welcome to the Daily Story Brief. Today, we are digging into a proposal that has just, completely reshaped the conversation around the war in Ukraine. We're talking about the new, very detailed, 28-point framework from the U.S. administration that's aimed at achieving peace.
And this isn't just another diplomatic effort. You know, this is a really high-stakes, comprehensive framework. It's emerged from some very quiet back-channel negotiations.
Right.
And its terms, they require these painful, almost existential concessions from Ukraine, while also offering these unprecedented security guarantees. But those guarantees are, well, they're deeply conditional. And for you, the listener, understanding the balance and the backlash in these 28 points is absolutely key to grasping where this conflict goes next.
Absolutely. We have the full text, and we're going to spend our time today unpacking the specific clauses. Everything from, massive territorial changes and military caps to what those NATO-like security guarantees actually mean in practice.
And why that distinction is so critical.
Exactly. Then we'll get into the firestorm of reactions from Kyiv, from Moscow, and from European capitals. This proposal, I think, whether it succeeds or fails, is forcing everyone to face some very, very difficult realities.
And before we even get into the text, we have to understand the backdrop. Who wrote this? How did this process even come about? And why did they bypass all the traditional diplomatic channels? Because the way it was made is exactly why it's so controversial.
So let's start right there with the origin story. Because it really does sound like something out of a political thriller.
This draft plan was quietly developed over the last month, not through the State Department or anything like that, but by two extremely colorful and unconventional figures.
That's the foundational controversy, the unofficial nature of it. You've got U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Russian Economic Envoy Kirill Dmitriev.
Right.
And by using personal envoys, you're signaling that you prioritize a deal, a personal deal, over institutional stability. And that creates immediate tension, especially with European allies. And when you look at the drafters themselves, that personal approach becomes even clearer. Tell us a bit about Steve Witkoff.
Witkoff is a fascinating figure in this. He's a 68-year-old New York real estate developer. And crucially, he's a loyal personal friend of the current U.S. administration head.
Okay.
He's working without pay, using his own private jet for official business. He is not a career diplomat. He is a political intermediary.
His team would point to his experience with the Israel-Hamas ceasefire, though, right?
They would. But you have to remember that ceasefire was largely prepared by the outgoing administration before he even stepped in.
I see.
And so his involvement here draws immediate scrutiny. According to reports, his team lacks deep Russia expertise. And during critical talks with President Putin, he apparently dispensed with a stenographer and relied entirely on Kremlin translators.
Wow. No independent record.
None. And that lack of oversight is a huge concern in these kinds of high-stakes talks. And some sources close to Kyiv have even accused him of sort of siding with Russian interests.
That really sets the stage. And then on the Russian side, we have Kirill Dmitriev.
Yes, Dmitriev is the head of the Russian Direct Investment Fund, the RDIF. He was actually born in Kyiv about 50 years ago. But now he makes a point of emphasizing he hails, in his words, not from Ukraine, but from the USSR.
So a very specific identity he's crafting there.
Very specific. He has a top-tier Western education, Stanford, Harvard, worked at McKinsey. He's really the face of Russian economic integration with the West.
And his reputation in the Kremlin.
Wildly ambitious. He has a talent for cultivating, let's say, the right friends. He's thought to be very close to Putin's family.
I see.
During the pandemic, he was the guy promoting the Sputnik V vaccine. But his key role here is economic cooperation. He thinks in terms of massive capital projects, shared resources. He even proposed a tunnel under the Bering Strait once.
So this is less like traditional statecraft and more like a boardroom takeover of a major conflict.
That's a perfect way to put it. You know, talks stalled back in October after the U.S. canceled a meeting with Putin and imposed some sanctions. It was Dmitriev who flew to the U.S., met with Witkoff in Miami for 3 days, and hammered out this draft plan. He's playing the economic fixer.
And this brings us to the core controversy over the plan's exclusivity. It was all done in secret, right? Largely without any direct European or even initial Ukrainian involvement.
Exactly. Some European diplomats said they only learned the details from the news.
Unbelievable.
The reaction was shock and frustration. You know, they are the primary backers of Ukraine financially and militarily, yet they were cut out of drafting the future security architecture of their own continent.
And the White House defense.
Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt insisted the team was engaged with both sides, Russia and Ukraine equally, and that they were seeking terms for a durable, lasting peace.
But that claim of equal engagement is directly challenged by Ukraine.
It is. Sources close to the Ukrainian government confirmed they were excluded from the drafting process itself. They were only informed of the broad strokes later on.
And the timing felt suspicious to them.
Very. It coincided with a major domestic corruption crisis in Kyiv, which we'll get into. It raised immediate suspicion that the U.S. was trying to force a bad deal on a weakened ally.
So the stage is set. An unofficial channel, unconventional negotiators trying to unilaterally impose a structure on this massive conflict.
Okay, let's unpack the hard numbers and the demands, because this is the section of the plan that immediately got labeled capitulation by critics.
That's right. The core of it requires Ukraine to make these huge, long-resisted concessions. Territory, military size, and its NATO status.
Let's start with the territory. Point 21. This is probably the hardest pill for Kyiv to swallow.
It is. It essentially ratifies Russia's biggest gains, both historical, like Crimea, and the more recent ones from the current invasion.
So walk us through the specifics. What regions would Ukraine have to permanently give up? The plan identifies three regions that would be permanently relinquished and, crucially, recognized de facto so, internationally recognized, including by the U.S. as Russian territory.
Which are?
Crimea, along with the Luhansk and Donetsk oblasts.
The whole Donbas region.
The entire Donbas region. And this is significant because even now, after years of brutal fighting, Russia only controls about 88% of it.
So Ukraine would be handing over the remaining 12% that they've been fiercely defending.
Exactly. Land they still control, just to get this peace.
But what about the other two regions Russia claimed to annex? Kherson and Zaporizhia.
For those two, the plan uses a frozen line concept. The border would just be frozen along the current line of contact, so that line becomes the de facto border.
Okay.
But the demands for the Donbas go even further. They require a buffer zone.
A buffer zone. Tell us about that. That sounds strategically critical.
It is. It's a major sticking point. Point 21 mandates a specific withdrawal. Ukrainian forces must pull back from parts of Donetsk Oblast they currently control. This area they withdraw from then becomes a neutral, demilitarized buffer zone. But here's the real kicker.
What's that?
Even this buffer zone would be internationally recognized as territory of the Russian Federation.
Wait, so Ukrainian troops pull out, it's demilitarized, but it's legally Russia's land.
Legally, it's ceded to Russia. Russian troops would be barred from entering it, but on a map, it's Russian.
So Russia gets all of Crimea, all of Donbas, including territory they haven't won militarily, and a frozen line elsewhere.
It fundamentally rewrites the map. And critics immediately said, this is capitulation. You're giving Putin territorial victories he failed to secure on the battlefield.
Is there anything Russia gives up?
The plan says Russia agrees to relinquish other agreed territories it controls outside those five regions. But the main prize, the industrial heartland of Donbas and Crimea, that all stays with Russia.
Okay, beyond territory, the plan puts severe restrictions on Ukraine's military. Moscow's been demanding this for years.
Yes, and these limits are designed to effectively neuter Ukraine as a significant long-term military power.
How so? What are the specifics?
First, a force cap. The size of Ukraine's armed forces would be limited to 600,000 personnel.
And that's a big cut.
A huge cut. A reduction of hundreds of thousands of active troops, according to reports. And they'd also be forbidden from having certain long-range weapons.
So a smaller army, fewer advanced weapons, that really degrades their ability to defend themselves. What about NATO?
This is the big one, point 7. It's a dual requirement. First, Ukraine must write into its own constitution that it will never join NATO.
A constitutional change.
But it goes further. NATO itself must include a corresponding statute that prohibits Ukraine's future admission.
So it's a lock on both sides, a legally binding commitment from Ukraine and from the alliance.
Exactly. It slams the door shut permanently.
What about foreign troops? Could they have, say, UN peacekeepers?
Nope. Explicitly barred. Points 8 and 9 clarify that. No NATO troops and no foreign forces at all, including peacekeepers. The country has to remain strategically neutralized.
But I thought I saw something in point 9 about fighter jets.
Yes, in what feels like a token gesture, it says European fighter jets will be stationed in Poland.
In Poland, not in Ukraine.
Correct. The idea is that air cover would have to come from outside its borders, while the country itself remains militarily reduced and constitutionally neutral.
This is a complete reversal of Ukraine's strategic goals since 2014.
It is. And this brings us to the central paradox of the whole plan. Ukraine is asked to trade its number one security goal, NATO's Article 5 collective defense, for a different kind of promise, a very specific but also highly conditional security promise.
So let's get into them. The plan promises reliable security guarantees in point 5. That sounds good on paper, but what does NATO, like, really mean here?
Well, a senior U.S. official confirmed the guarantee is modeled on Article 5 principles. This means the U.S. and its European allies would view an attack on Ukraine as an attack on the transatlantic community. That's very potent diplomatic language.
Okay, so they'd view it that way. But what would they do? What's the response?
If Russia invades this new, smaller Ukraine again, the response would include 3 concrete actions. First, a decisive, coordinated military response. Second, the immediate reinstatement of all global sanctions. And third, Russia loses recognition for the new territories it gained. All the benefits of the deal are gone.
A decisive, coordinated military response. That's the part that sounds NATO-like. But let's be really clear here. Does that commit U.S. troops to the battlefield?
And that is the crucial ambiguity. That is the difference between NATO-like and NATO.
Right.
The source material is very deliberate in its wording. It says they would view the attack as an attack on the community, and the response would be a coordinated military response. It does not explicitly say who executes it or what kind of forces are deployed.
So, hypothetically, if the U.S. sends drones and intelligence support, but no boots on the ground.
Does that count? It feels like a lot of wiggle room.
That's the entire point. It's deterrence theater. Article 5 is a legally binding guarantee that triggers immediate mandatory action. This plan promises mandatory consultation and action, but the intensity and nature of that action are, well, they're negotiable. They're subject to the political will of future leaders.
Which makes it fundamentally less reliable than actual NATO membership.
Exactly. And that's why Kyiv is so deeply skeptical.
And these guarantees, they also come with some very strict conditions for Ukraine itself.
Absolutely. The plan specifies how Ukraine can lose these guarantees. If Ukraine invades Russia, they're gone. And this is a very specific one. If Ukraine launches a missile at Moscow or St. Petersburg without cause, the guarantee is void.
Without cause. That's an interesting qualifier.
It is. Also, the U.S. receives compensation for providing the guarantee, which sort of turns it into a paid service. It commercializes the whole arrangement. But there's one point here, point 22, that seems to lock in the territorial concessions permanently.
This is the critical limitation. It's the point that turns this from a defense pact into a permanent territorial settlement. It says the security guarantees do not apply if either Russia or Ukraine tries to alter the agreed-upon borders by force.
So if Ukraine ever tried to militarily retake Crimea or the Donbas, the guarantee is gone. They're on their own.
They forfeit the only protection they received in the deal. They would be trading their sovereign right to restore their 1991 borders in exchange for this NATO-like shield.
So the guarantee is a shield against a future invasion of the new Ukraine, but it's also a chain preventing Ukraine from ever undoing the deal.
That's the fundamental paradox, protection in exchange for self-limitation. And that's why many Ukrainian officials see the security part as just woefully insufficient.
Okay, so beyond the tail field, this deal offers a massive financial carrot, especially for reconstruction, and a path for Russia to get out of isolation. Let's look at the financial architecture.
The plan promises a powerful global package for rebuilding Ukraine. Modernization, infrastructure, resource extraction. This is the sweetener for Kyiv. And the immediate focus is on mobilizing those hundreds of billions in frozen Russian assets.
How exactly would those funds be used, according to point 14? And, you know, who benefits?
It's a complex, multi-layered mechanism, and it's already raised some eyebrows in Europe. First, $100 billion in frozen Russian assets would be invested in U.S.-led efforts for Ukraine's reconstruction. Of the profits generated from this venture, the actual returns on the investment, the U.S. would receive a full 50%.
Wait, hold on. $100 billion in Russian assets goes into a U.S.-led fund, and the U.S. gets 50% of the profits from rebuilding Ukraine.
That's what the plan says.
That sounds less like pure aid and more like a major financial incentive for the U.S. to broker this deal.
It definitely adds a commercial layer to the diplomacy. It frames the U.S. role not just as a security guarantor, but as a primary financial beneficiary of the peace framework.
What about Europe?
Europe is supposed to add another $100 billion for reconstruction. But the main mechanism for using the frozen Russian assets is structured to reward U.S. corporate involvement.
So that's the carrot for Ukraine. What about Russia? What's their path back to global standing?
The plan offers Russia a clear route back. Sanctions would be lifted in stages, case by case, tied to compliance, and critically, Russia would be invited to rejoin the G8, restoring the status it lost after annexing Crimea in 2014.
And there's also a long-term economic cooperation deal mandated between the U.S. and Russia.
Yes, a massive one. It covers energy, natural resources, AI, data centers, and even Arctic rare earth metal extraction. It's a full revival of bilateral economic ties.
So let's talk about the political and legal restructuring. How does the plan ensure Russia holds up its end? And what demands are placed on Kyiv?
For Russia, point 16 requires it to write a policy of non-aggression towards Europe and Ukraine into its own laws. And it mandates a new dialogue between Russia and NATO, mediated by the U.S.
And for Ukraine, the political process kicks off immediately.
Yes. Ukraine must hold elections in 100 days.
100 days. That's an incredibly short timeline, especially during a period of national crisis and concession.
It introduces huge domestic political volatility.
And then we get to one of the most controversial points, point 26, the amnesty clause.
This one has explosive implications. It says all parties involved in the conflict would receive full amnesty for actions during the war and agree not to pursue future claims.
All parties involved. Does that include political figures and people implicated in war crimes, or even the recent corruption scandals in Kyiv?
That ambiguity, many critics argue, is intentional. It's a sweeping measure to wipe the slate completely clean. It effectively eliminates international legal pressure, especially on investigations into alleged war crimes by Russian forces in places like Bucha. It's a massive concession for Russia.
But the moral cost for Kyiv, to agree to amnesty for those responsible for the most brutal acts of the war, it's immense.
It is. And as you mentioned, it could also potentially shield figures involved in wartime corruption if they're deemed involved in the conflict. It's a convenient legal shield for both sides.
And finally, who oversees all of this?
The agreement would be legally binding, monitored, and guaranteed by a peace council led by the U.S. administration head, Donald J. Trump. He would effectively control the consequences of any future violations. And an immediate ceasefire takes effect once all parties agree.
So the timing of this proposal could not have been worse for Kyiv.
Not at all. It arrived as President Zelensky was already facing intense pressure, militarily and politically. It made his response an incredibly difficult tightrope walk.
His official public response was so careful, wasn't it? Very diplomatic.
Extremely calculated. He confirmed he got the plan and said he intends to speak with President Trump about diplomatic opportunities.
He used phrases like constructive, honest, and swift work. But then he added that the proposals must be genuine and deliver a dignified peace.
And that phrase, dignified peace, is diplomatic code for this cannot be a capitulation.
He also seemed to be making a public plea, saying Ukraine needs a real peace, one that will not be broken by a third invasion, and that the U.S. has the power to ensure that Russia's willingness to end the war finally becomes serious.
That is precisely the tightrope. He's basically saying, use your leverage to get a better deal from Putin. Don't force these terms on us.
Because he can't just reject it outright.
He can't. The U.S. cut off financial aid. He can't risk alienating the broker of this deal. It would be catastrophic.
But internally, in Kyiv, the reaction was not so diplomatic.
Not at all. It was fierce and immediate. Officials called it unrealistic, absurd, and dangerous. Oleksandr Mereshko, who heads the Foreign Affairs Committee, called it absolutely senseless and warned it could be a Russian provocation just to buy time.
And one lawmaker, Yaroslav Yurkishin, he drew a very dark historical parallel.
Yes, he compared it to the 1938 Munich Agreement, where Czechoslovakia was forced to trade territory for what turned out to be illusory security guarantees.
That comparison shows the deep fear that this is just a pause before the next war.
It does, and you have to remember the domestic context. This plan landed right in the middle of a massive corruption scandal in Kyiv.
Tell us about that.
The investigation is looking into the alleged theft of $100 million, and it implicated his former business partner. It forced him to dismiss two cabinet ministers. It has seriously shaken his government.
And this internal weakness creates a political vulnerability.
A vulnerability that Western diplomats suggest the timing was designed to exploit. One diplomat said Kirill Dmitriev spun this plan at a time when Zelensky is weak, hoping a vulnerable leader could be forced to accept it.
So it's a pressure tactic.
Absolutely. Ukraine is facing nightly bombardment of its energy sector. Russian forces are making gains in the east. They have manpower shortages. It is an excruciating time to be presented with what many there view as surrender terms.
So it sounds like the plan is winning very few friends among Ukraine's allies. What are the key objections coming from Europe?
The reaction from European capitals was one of immediate and deep unease. The EU officially said it was troubled by the plan. One official just called it capitulation.
And their main argument against it.
They rejected its moral premise. The EU foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, stressed that in this war, there is one aggressor and one victim.
Right.
She pointed out that Russia has made no visible concessions. They're just formalizing gains they took by force. Mm. Her point was that rewarding aggression only encourages more aggression.
And other major European powers echoed that.
They did. French and Spanish officials were adamant that peace cannot be a capitulation and must guarantee a sovereign, democratic Ukrainian state. And the British government emphasized that only the Ukrainian people can determine their future.
So Europe sees it as a Russian blueprint, dressed up as a peace plan. How did Moscow respond publicly to a plan they helped write?
Officially, the Kremlin played it very cool, very ambivalent. Spokesperson Dmitry Peskov initially said Moscow had nothing new to add. They later even denied that any negotiations were underway, claiming they were just waiting for Ukraine's official response.
Which gives them plausible deniability if it fails.
Exactly. But the Russian economic envoy, Dmitriev, the co-author, he was quietly confident. He said, "We feel the Russian position is really being heard."
Really being heard. That says a lot.
It confirms that Russia believes the framework meets their maximalist demands, especially on territory and military neutralization.
And we also saw some pretty shocking speculation from Kremlin-aligned commentators about what happens if Zelensky says no.
This is where you see the dark side of the pressure campaign. One commentator, a former U.S. Army officer named Stanislav Kropivnik, he openly speculated about drastic consequences.
Like what?
Financial blackmail, for one, a massive smear campaign portraying Zelensky as a warmonger rejecting peace. And then he mentioned a forceful scenario.
A forceful scenario.
An internal coup led by the military. Or even, and he called this the most radical option, a heroic death.
My goodness. That's not diplomacy, that's outright intimidation.
It is. It's designed to make it clear that rejection carries a very high, very personal risk.
So to really understand the intensity of the resistance here, we have to look beyond the pragmatic demands and address what critics see as the plan's fundamental flaw.
Right. And that flaw is the failure to recognize President Putin's true imperial ambitions. The argument is that this U.S. plan is based on a fatal misunderstanding of Putin's motivation. It views him through a Western lens of cost-benefit analysis.
The idea that he can be bargained with through economic incentives or land swaps.
Precisely. Critics, including those at the Atlantic Council, say it's delusional to think that he can be satisfied by promises of minor territorial concessions. They believe he's not driven by simple military costs or GDP. He's driven by a perceived existential struggle to revive Russia's great power status and secure his own place in history.
So if his goals are historical and geopolitical, not transactional, then offering him an economic off-ramp is just missing the point.
It's worse than missing the point. The source material highlights that the U.S. administration's approach, comparing this to a property dispute, overlooks the fact that Putin is fighting for Ukraine itself, not just pieces of land. His stated goal is to extinguish Ukrainian independence.
And he's been quite public about this, comparing himself to Peter the Great.
He has. He talks about returning historically Russian lands. He's basically said, all Ukraine is ours. For someone with that mindset, a joint venture for Arctic rare earth metals is not going to satisfy them.
So from that perspective, offering concessions is actually counterproductive.
It is. It just convinces Putin that his opponents are weak, that they lack the political will and historical stamina to stand up to him. It confirms his belief that if he just pushes hard enough, the West will eventually back down.
So the core critique is that this plan, by rewarding aggression, actually guarantees future conflict.
Exactly. Instead of trying to find pragmatic off-ramps, critics argue that Ukraine's allies have to acknowledge that Putin is playing for the highest possible stakes, and he has no interest in a compromise that leaves a sovereign, viable Ukraine intact.
Okay, so we have this detailed plan, we have intense opposition, and we have a very cautious President Zelensky who can't afford to just say no. What actually happens next?
The diplomatic path is on an aggressive timeline pushed by the U.S. Zelensky's office has confirmed that Ukrainian and U.S. teams are already working on the plan's points. Technical consultations are underway.
So they are engaging, even if it's just to stall or try to modify the terms.
Right. And we can expect direct, high-level contact soon. A call between Zelensky and the U.S. administration head is expected next week.
That will be the real moment of truth.
It will be. And at the same time, U.S. officials are briefing EU ambassadors in Kyiv, trying to build consensus where there is currently deep skepticism. The administration wants a framework agreement signed in the shortest possible time.
And meanwhile, the war on the ground just continues.
It continues unabated, and Russia is escalating its tactics to apply maximum pressure. They're using glide bombs, they plan to produce 120,000 next year, and missiles to hit energy infrastructure, to hit civilian areas.
We saw the attack on Chernobyl, 28 dead.
And Zaporizhia, 5 killed. These attacks are designed to undermine morale and make the prospect of peace, even an unfavorable one, more palatable.
So what's Zelensky's strategy here? He's in such a difficult position.
He's likely playing for time. He has to be seen as engaging constructively, but he's also trying to persuade the U.S. to use its leverage to pressure Putin into greater concessions.
To get a better deal, basically.
To get a better deal. And at the same time, European allies are continuing to secure their own defense cooperation deals directly with Ukraine. Spain's allocating money for co-production. Germany is considering sending Taurus missiles. That gives Key a little more breathing room.
So the outcome of that call next week will be a critical indicator of which way this is going to go.
It will show whether the U.S. is willing to accept substantial modifications or if it insists on this framework, which so many allies view as codifying Russia's maximalist demands.
So we've reviewed a monumental peace plan that, if enacted, would fundamentally redraw the map of Europe. Yet it's criticized by so many as a blueprint for capitulation.
And what's really fascinating here is how this 28-point proposal tries to use massive financial reconstruction, leveraging those frozen Russian assets, with the U.S. taking 50% of the profits, and this carefully worded conditional security guarantee as compensation for these huge territorial losses. It really raises an important question for you, the listener. Is this framework a genuine path to ending the killing, or does its reliance on imperial concessions guarantee instability, simply pausing a conflict that's driven by motivations that go way beyond territory and economics?
That is something worth considering very deeply. Thank you for joining us for this Daily Story Brief.
Final provocative thought. The plan offers full amnesty for all parties involved in this conflict. Considering the current high-profile corruption scandal in Ukraine and the ongoing investigations into war crimes and atrocities, what are the irreversible moral and legal costs of granting a universal, sweeping amnesty just to achieve a political ceasefire?